In Our Lives by Ernest Hemingway. On the quay at Smyrna. The strange thing was, he said, how they screamed every night at midnight. I do not know why they screamed at that time. We were in the harbor and they were all on the prey. And at that time they started screaming. We used to turn the searchlight on them to quiet them. That always did the trick. We would run the searchlight up and down over them 2 or 3 times and they stopped it. One time I was senior officer on a prayer and a Turkish officer came to me in a frightful rage because one of our sailors had been most insulting to him. So I told him the fellow would be sent on the ship and be most severely punished. I asked him to point him out. So he pointed out a gunner's mate, most inoffensive chap, said he had been most frightfully and repeatedly insulting, talking to me through an interpreter. I couldn't imagine how the gunner mate knew enough Turkish to be insulting. I called him over and said, and just in case you should have spoken to any Turkish officer.
I haven't spoken to any of them, sir.
I'm quite sure of it, I said. But you would best go on board ship and not come ashore again for the rest of the day. Then I told the Turk the man was being sent on a boat ship and would be most severely dealt with. Oh, most rigorously. He felt topping about it. Great friends we were. The worst, he said, were the women with the dead babies. You couldn't get the women to give up their dead babies. They would have babies dead for 6 days, wouldn't give up them. Nothing you could do about it. Had to take them away finally. Then there was an old lady. Most extraordinary case. I told it to a doctor and he said I was lying. We were clearing them off the pier. Had to clear off the dead ones. And this old woman was lying on a sort of litter. They said, will you have a look at her, sir? So I had to look at her. And just then she died and went absolutely stiff. Her legs drew up and she drew up from the waist and went quite rigid. Exactly as though she has been dead overnight. She was quite dead and absolutely rigid. I told a medical officer chap about it and he told me it was impossible. They were all out there on the prayer and it wasn't at all like an earthquake or that sort of a thing because they never knew about the Turk. They never knew what the old Turk would do. You remember when they ordered us not to come in to take off any more? I had to wind up when we came in that morning. He had any amount of batteries and could have blown us clean out of the water. We were going to come in. Run close along the pier, let go the front and rear anchors and then shell the Turkish quarters of the town. They would have blown us out of the water, but we would have blown the town simply to hell. They just fired a few blanks charges at us as we came in. Kemal came down and sacked the Turkish commander for exceeding his authority or some such thing. He got a bit above himself. It would have been the hell of a mess. You remember the harbor. There were plenty of nice things floating around in it. That was the only time in my life I got so I dreamed about things. You don't mind the women who were having babies as you did those with the dead ones. They had them all right. Surprisingly, how few of them died. You just covered them over with something or let them go to it. They would always pick up the darkest place in the hold to have them. None of them minded anything once they got off the pier. The Greeks were nice chaps too. When they evacuated, they had all their baggage, animals they couldn't take off with them, so they just broke their forelegs and dumped them in a shallow water. All those mules with their forelegs broken pushed over the shallow water. It was all pleasant business. My words, yes, a most pleasant business. Chapter 1. Everybody was drunk. The whole battery was drunk going along the road in the dark. We were going to the champagne. The lieutenant kept riding his horse out into the fields and saying to him, I'm drunk, I tell you. Mon vie. Oh, I'm so soused.
We went along the road all night in the dark, and Ajahn kept riding up alongside my kitchen and saying, "You must put an halt. It is dangerous. It will be observed." We were 50 kilometers from the front, but the Ajahn worried about the fire in the kitchen. It was funny going along the road. That was when I was a kitchen corporal. Indian camp. At the lake shore, there was another rowboat drawn up. The two Indians stood waiting. Nick and his father got in the stern of the boat, and the Indians shouted off, and one of them got into row. Uncle George sat in the stern of the camp rowboat. The young Indian shoved the camp boat off and got into row Uncle George. The two boats started off in the dark. Nick heard the oarlocks of the other boat quite away ahead of them in the midst. The Indians rowed the quick, choppy strokes. Nick lay back with his father's arm around him. It was cold on the water. The Indian who was rowing them was working very hard, but the other boat moved further ahead in the mist all the time. "Where are you going, Dad?" Nick asked. "Over the Indian camp. There is an Indian lady very sick." "Oh," Nick said. Across the bay, they found the other boat beached. Uncle George was smoking a cigar in the dark. The young Indian pulled the boat away up on the beach. Uncle George gave both the Indians a cigar. They walked up on the beach through a meadow that was soaking wet with dew, following the young Indian who carried a lantern. Then they went into the woods and followed a trail that led to a logging road that ran back into the hills. It was much lighter on the logging roads as the timber was cut away on both sides. The young Indian stopped and blew out his lantern, and they walked on along the road. They came around a bend, and a dog came out barking. Ahead were the lights of the shanties, where the Indian bark peelers live. More dogs rushed out at them. The two Indians sent them back to their shanties. In the shanty near the road, there was a light in the window. An old woman stood in the doorway holding a lamp. Inside a wooden bunk lay a young Indian woman. She had been trying to have her baby for 2 days. All the old women in the camp have been helping her. The men had moved off up the road to sit in the dark and smoke out of the rage of the noise she made. She screamed just as Nick and the two Indians followed his father and Uncle George into the shanty. She laid in the lower bunk, very big under a quilt. Her head was turned to one side. The upper bunk was her husband. He had cut his foot very badly with an axe 3 days before. He was smoking a pipe. The room smelled very bad. Nick's father ordered some water to be put on the stove, and while it was heating, he spoke to Nick. "This lady is going to have a baby, Nick," he said. "I know," said Nick. "You don't know," said his father. "Listen to me. What she is going through is called being in labor. The baby wants to be born, and she wants it to be born. All her muscles are trying to get the baby born. That is what is happening when she screams." "I see," Nick said. Just then the woman cried out, "Oh, Daddy, can't you give her something to make her stop screaming?" asked Nick. "No, I haven't any anesthetic," his father said. "But her screams are not important. I don't hear them because they are not important." The husband in the upper bunk rolled over against the wall. The women in the kitchen motioned to the doctor that the water was hot. Nick's father went into the kitchen and poured about half of the water out of a big kettle into a basin. Into the water left in a kettle, he put several things he unwrapped with his handkerchief. "Those must boil," he said, and began to scrub his hands in the basin of hot water with a cake of soap he had brought from the camp. Nick watched his father's hands scrubbing each other with the soap. While his father washed his hands very carefully and thoroughly, he talked. "You see, Nick, babies are supposed to be born head first, and sometimes they are not. When they are not, they make a lot of trouble for everyone. Maybe I'll have to operate on this lady. We'll know in a little while." When he was satisfied with his hand, he went in and went to work. "Pull back that milk, will you, George?" he said. "I would rather not touch it." Later, when he started to operate, Uncle George and 3 Indian men held the women still. She bit Uncle George on the arm and Uncle George said, "Damn, squatch bitch!" And the young Indian who had rode Uncle George over laughed at him. Nick held the basin for his father. It all took a long time. His father picked the baby up and slapped it, make it breathe, and handed it to the old woman. "See, it's a boy, Nick," he said. "How do you like being an internee?" Nick said, "All right." He was looking away so not to see what his father was doing. "There, that gets it," said his father and put something in the basin. Nick didn't look at it. "Now," his father said, "there are some stitches to put in. You can watch this or not, Nick, just as you like. I'm going to sew up the incisions I made." Nick did not watch. His curiosity has been gone for a long time. His father finished and stood up. Uncle George and three Indian men stood up. Nick put the basin out in the kitchen. Uncle George looked at his arm. The young Indian boy smiled reminiscently. "I'll put some peroxide on that, George," the doctor said. He bent over the Indian woman. She was quiet now, and her eyes were closed. She looked very pale. She did not know what had become of the baby or anything. "I'll be back in the morning," the doctor said, standing up. "The nurse should be here from St. Ignace by noon, and she'll bring everything we need." He was feeling exalted and talkative as football players are in the dressing room after the game. "That's one for the medical journal, George," he said. "Doing cesarean with a jackknife and sewing it up with 9-foot tapered gut leaders." Uncle George was standing against the wall looking at his arm. "Oh, you are a great man, all right," he said. "Ah, to have a look at a proud father. They are usually the worst sufferers in these little affairs," the doctor said. "I must say he'll look it all very quietly." He pulled back the blanket from the Indian's head. His hand came away wet. He mounted on the edge of the lower bunk with the lamp in his hand and looked in. The Indian lay with his face towards the wall. His throat has been cut from ear to ear. The blood has flown down in a pool where his body sagged the bunk. His head rested on the left arm. The open razor lay edge up in the blanket.
"Take Nick out of the shanty, George," the doctor said.
"There is no need of that." Nick, standing in the door of the kitchen, he had a good view of an upper bunk where his father, the lamp in his hand, tipped the Indian's head back. It was just beginning to be daylight when they walked along the logging roads back towards the lake.
"I'm terribly sorry I brought you along, Nicky," said the father, all his post-operative acceleration gone. "And it was an awful mess to put you through."
"Do ladies always have such a hard time having babies?" Nick asked. "No, that was very, very exceptional."
"Why did he kill himself, Daddy?"
"I don't know, Nick. He couldn't stand things, I guess."
"Do many men kill themselves, Daddy?"
"Not many, Nick."
"Do many women?"
"Hardly ever."
"Don't they ever?"
"Oh, yes, they do sometimes. Daddy?"
"Yes?"
"Where did Uncle George go?"
"He'll turn up all right."
"Is dying hard, Daddy?"
"No, I think it's pretty easy, Nick. It all depends."
They were seated in the boat, Nick in the stern, his father rowing. The sun was coming up over the hills. Bays jumped, making a circle in the water. Nick trailed his hand in the water. It felt warm in the sharp chill of the morning. In the early morning on the lake, sitting in the stern of the boat with his father rowing, he felt quite sure that he would never die.